The Senate Judiciary Committee will come to order. The record should reflect that it is 1:40 on Wednesday, March 14th. There is a quorum present. Present today are Senators Huggins, Senator Terrio, Senator Wilikowski, myself, Senator French. We're here today to continue work on SB 64, a bill relating to ethics. Also on the calendar today is SB 78, window tinting, and SB 89, electronic monitoring for gang probationers. The last time we had SB 64 in front of us was just on Monday, and there was some discussion about a few amendments to the bill before it left our committee. I have a couple prepared today, and one should be in front of you. The one that's immediately in front of us is /echo.5, E.5. I'll move the amendment if someone would object to it for the purposes of discussion.
Object.
Thank you, Senator Huggins. Amendment, this amendment, and is there a number? Should we be giving these a number? Is amendment number one? Thank you. If you'd all put a number one up there to keep us and the clerk straight, it's always helpful. Amendment number one relates to campaign contributions. And the idea came up, actually the loophole in the state law came to light last summer with a opinion from Ledge Legal that under the way the law was currently written, it was not against the law for a candidate to receive a bribe in the form of a campaign contribution, that the law just didn't cover that eventuality. So while it seemed, well, in any event, it seemed like this is the time and the place to fix that loophole, and so that's what the amendment number one is intended to do. Let me walk the members of the committee and the public through the amendment and how it would work. You can see that the section on line six, it refers to AS 1156-130. That is a definitional statute that relates to the two preceding statutes, 1156-100 and 1156-110. 1156-100 is about bribery, and 1156-110 is about receiving a bribe. And both statutes are phrased in these terms. A person commits the crime of bribery if the person confers, offers to confer, agrees to confer a benefit upon a public service, a servant. And then 110 is in the same phraseology. It's about soliciting a benefit or accepting or agreeing to accept a benefit. And in receiving a bribe, it says accepting or agrees to accept a benefit upon an agreement or understanding that the public servant's vote, opinion, judgment, action, decision, or exercise of discretion as a public servant will be influenced. That's what receiving a bribe, that's the crime of receiving a bribe. So the definition section of 1156-130, you may note, accepts political campaign contributions. That's an exception. And so that's the loophole, if you will. And so the language of the amendment, the operative language of the amendment says this, and it's on lines 10, 11, and 12. A political campaign contribution, in essence, is not a bribe unless the contribution is made or received in exchange for an agreement to alter an elected official's or candidate's vote or position on a state administrative matter or legislative or municipal matter. That's the sum and substance, if you will, of the amendment. So you can, I mean, it's plain how it would work in real life. If someone brought you a campaign contribution and said, this contribution is contingent upon you voting this way or voting that way, that's in essence a bribe, and that would be illegal. It may be difficult to prove, it may be impossible to prove, but it seems like it's important to at least put on the statute books that that's the idea that you're trying to foreclose, that quid pro quo of a contribution in exchange for a promise of the promise of a agreement to alter your position on an administrative matter or legislative or municipal matter. Just to be clear, it's not a bribe if you say, I'm supporting you because you're against an income tax. You've been against an income tax forever. You've always been against an income tax. I trust you're never going to vote for an income tax. Here's your campaign contribution because I hate income taxes. That's totally fine.
Me.
Thank you, Senator Huggins, for an explanation. I'm sorry the gavel to gavel wasn't here to catch that.
I'm glad they're not here.
It is a little bit of a relief, is it not?
Touch your noses.
But what is illegal is if I offer you a $500 or $1,000 campaign contribution if you agree to change your position on the Pebble Mine, or if you agree to change your position on a sales tax or an income tax. That's the quid pro quo that this amendment would preclude.
Yeah.
Again, it may be difficult, if not impossible, to prove. But nevertheless, I think it's important for the public to know that that's the idea. And if you can prove it, you've committed a crime. So that's my amendment, and I'd be happy to answer questions from members. Senator Terrio.
So, Mr. Chairman, the crime of bribery did exist, and still exists. That's unchanged. And I'm just wondering, I mean, the example of you've been steadfast, you're pro-development, and, you know, we're going to support you in the campaign. But now this language, you only trigger it if you actually change a position? But what if somebody comes forward and says, you've always been there, we expect you to be there in the future, and here's the campaign contribution, we want to keep you in our stable.
And they have weapons sitting by closely.
Well, no, but I haven't changed. I intend to continue to vote because that's what my constituents want. But if there's sort of a wink and a nod that, well, this is going to keep you, you know, on our side, is that less of a bribe? I mean, that. I would show the door to eat the person either way, show them to the door.
Right. Most ethical, I think it's important for the public to know, most ethical candidates say, I'm happy to have your support. I can't promise you what I'm going to do in the future. You're electing me because you trust my judgment and my ability to be fair.
Right.
I think that's what
but
99.
That's not what this says.
Right.
It also talks about it could be made. It talks about the other person's intent. Or, I mean, if I gave it to you and my intent was to try to then.
But there has to be in exchange for, right? So it's not you can give it to me with that intent that I change my position on income taxes, change my position on the Pebble Mine, but unless you get that promise back in exchange, see a couple words over, then there hasn't been then you
get to the part
the
about what is an agreement? I mean, is it a head nod? Is it a hey? I mean, I'm mm-hmm. looking at, I mean, it appears that you're being held accountable for somebody else's conduct potentially versus your own. Made. It says made.
Right.
Is made.
Made.
In, or.
Mm-hmm. Or received. Right.
So it's either act.
Both parties would be equally culpable, equally guilty. Right. And again, there may be, I don't dispute there'll be proof problems. I'm not saying this would be an easy crime to prove because, again, you could offer the money, I could be silent.
Right.
You could offer the money, I could wink. You could offer the money, I could say, blood oath, I will change my position on the Pebble Mine. And in the last case is easy to prove, the middle case is difficult, and the first one's probably impossible if I don't say anything.
Or if I made a contribution to you for Trial Lawyers Association, from the Trial Lawyers Association, and I made it, and I said, wait, I was fully convinced that we turned Hollis' position on it.
And you could walk out of the room saying, I know yeah. I changed his mind. Right. I know I did.
Right. We agreed.
Right. And
he didn't disagree.
And then if you wanted to run to the police and say, I've just committed the crime of bribery, and I think Senator French did too, then we'd have a proof problem.
Yeah, I'm looking at the
but I and, yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
I agree. There will always be proof problems, particularly in this arena, which takes place certainly behind closed doors and in private. Nevertheless, it's you can see the way the law reads right now. The law reads right now that political campaign contributions are absolutely precluded from any a hint of there ever being a bribe. And I think you can imagine many instances when they are in fact used that way. Although I'll be candid, I can't think of an instance where it's come to light in the state of Alaska. But Senator McGuire and then Senator Wilkowski.
I'm embarrassed because I can't remember this. There's like the briber and the bribee, I think it is. But so if you are just bifurcating it, so if you make the contribution, okay, it's the exchange is what it is. So the exchange has to be there. So someone could have the intent to make it. I could go into your office and have money well, you wouldn't be going in someone's office, but let's say going to a fundraiser.
Fundraiser.
And I could say, I have the intent to alter Hollis's, Senator French's position on something in exchange for this money in my pocket, which would likely be about $20. And I would say that I have that intent, but unless you understand that I have that intent and agree with it and get it and do it in some ascertainable, provable way, then this doesn't apply.
I think that's right.
Okay. The agreement. Just like we can all walk around with bad motives or bad thoughts, and so long as we don't follow through with them.
I think it's the agreement that protects 99 out of 100 candidates from, right. It's the agreement that protects us from false charges and from false accusations. Because it will be difficult, if not impossible, to prove absent a tape recording or a photograph or something like that. The blood oath. Senator Wilikowski was next, and then Terrio.
I think what this amendment addresses is a situation where someone walks up to you and says, I will give you $500 if you agree to vote for or against X. Right now, under the current law, that is arguably legal to do. I think this changes that. I wonder if we want to add something to it, though. Similarly to what Senator Terrio was talking about with alter, what if someone comes to you and says, well, I will give you $500 if you agree to continue to have your position on this, or if you don't have a position, then you haven't altered your position necessarily, or have you? Do you think you have? I don't know. So I'm wondering if we want to add something that that kind of expands on alter, so that if someone comes to you and says, keep this position and I will give you $500, that would make it a crime.
Yeah.
Senator Terrio.
So I guess I'm just wondering, do you want to tag it to actually a switch in position, or that you are giving the money in exchange for a particular position that you've changed, or you're going to continue? I mean, I don't know that anybody giving me money and saying, okay, now I'm buying your continued support, is any different than I'm giving you money and I want you to switch your position from what it's been historically.
I think we need to think very carefully about that, because most of us have been in campaign situations when you say to a group, you know I support you. Uh-huh. I've supported you in the past. I'm going to support you in the future. That's just my basic position on this issue is, X or Y. And people think about that and go, okay. And you can issue all the caveats you want. I can't promise you how I'll vote on any bill. Can't promise how I'm going to vote on anything. But I'm generally in favor of your, whether it's pro-labor, pro-business, pro-development, anti-development, pro-trial lawyer, pro-doctor, whatever it is. Yeah. Your record is fairly clear, and your position is fairly clear, so I think that would be far more problematic, because the essence of bribery is changing your mind, is buying your influence and buying your support in a corrupt way, in a way that didn't already exist.
So, Mr. Chairman, are there bad acts that currently are not being covered by the statutes now? Because if you do that, you're still guilty of bribery, aren't you? Or because of this exception, no, you're not guilty of anything at all.
Right now, I think it's perfectly legal for someone to say, I can gather up $20,000 in campaign contributions if you promise me you'll never vote for X or Y.
Okay, but it is... And I guess back when the statutes were crafted the way they were and that exemption was in there, it would be interesting to know if there was debate to say, yeah, but the money's fully disclosed by source in a campaign, right. And all of that. And that's what keeps us out of, this sticky discussion that we're having right now. I'm not opposed, but I
understand. That's a fair counter argument, I think. Fair counter argument is, look, it used to be $1,000, now it's $500. Okay. My goodness. What do you really think you can get for $500?
Let me give you a real life example that's going on with me right now.
Careful.
Well, I'm trying to think about, oftentimes you take positions early on in your career, I would say, or early on in your service as a lawmaker, that you reflect back on, and it actually has to do with the RCA. And you know, you make these decisions, and you really think you know everything, and that you're going at it from a point of knowledge. And then later on in your career, either through exposure to different individuals, different experiences, and so forth, you start to recognize that maybe you didn't have all the information at that point in time. And you start opening your mind, and you have to do it carefully because your ego is usually the biggest boundary. And so let's just say that you were anti-trial lawyer. Let's use tort reform. Let's just say that you were fully in support of tort reform. You just absolutely believe that it was the thing to do. And so quite naturally, coming behind you are going to be all the people that love tort reform. You know, the Independent Business Federation, the chambers, the insurance guys, the doctors, so on and so forth. And then let's just say later on, you decided, you know, I don't like tort reform. I don't agree with it as a policy. And for whatever reason, maybe you went on some life-changing, altering mecca, and you came back and changed your opinion. Maybe you had read a book or talked to somebody. Then all of a sudden, you are it's a campaign cycle. You're in a conversation with the head of the trial lawyers who says, look, Lisa, I mean, you know, I know you haven't really supported our position on tort reform, but... you know, and then I say, well, you know, actually, I got to tell you something. I've been thinking about that. And this actually isn't a real life example, by the way. I decided not to use the real life example in the RCA for my own protection. But anyway, not for my own, just because it's too convoluted. But anyway, so let's just say this were happening. And I said, you know, just to let you know, I'm actually thinking about changing my mind. And what if that head of the trial lawyers then went back to their respective lawyers and came back to me and said, you know, we think that you're, however they want to phrase it, open-mindedness, maybe they say your new view on tort reform to us says we want to support you in office. Is that a violation of this?
I don't think so. It's a great example, and I think it's probably the closest to the line. But again, I think you didn't change your mind. The contribution wasn't made in exchange for an agreement to change your mind.
Because they gave me the money.
You changed your mind first, okay? Right? And in your example, you would win that debate because you'd say, "Hey, I talked to someone on the way back from Mecca. I talked to someone and said, you know what? I've had a new view on, or you would have proof in that you talked to the trial lawyer person first and said, you know what? I've had a change of heart, and he goes back to his organization and says, hey, I think we've got a candidate that's going to back us now. Let's contribute some money there.
Because that does happen. Sure. You change your views.
But if he comes to you and says, you know what, I've got 20 trial lawyers outside with their checkbooks open, and what they want from you is a promise that you're going to change your mind, and you go, you know what, okay, then I think that's looks an awful lot to the public like you've been bribed.
Yeah.
And you've had your mind changed by those open checkbooks, those evil trial lawyers. Just kidding.
Yes.
Other questions or debate on that, Senator Huggins?
Would a vote just the act of somebody voting for you, would that qualify
as proof of an exchange?
Yeah.
I would not take it to be proof of the exchange. The proof is the agreement, made or in exchange for an agreement, and so you'd have to show the blood oath, the handshake, the you know, hall of lawyers waiting outside with checkbooks. Yeah. That's the proof of the agreement to change your mind in exchange for the money. Other questions or comments? Senator Willekowski.
Yeah, just kind of a clarification. I think this is a good discussion to have because it really clarifies it for the record in the event we do pass this. I'm thinking of a situation. We all get questionnaires during elections. And if you answer your questionnaire, then that is evaluated by the organization, and they say, well, I like this questionnaire. I'm going to give him $1,000. I guess I would just like a little bit of discussion on the thinking on something like that. And I guess there's a mens rea that has to be met under this, and so the organization did not attempt to have you change your position in exchange for that questionnaire. I'm just curious, are we covering this? I just want to make sure that we have this. discussion, at least, and certainly no intent on my part to prohibit that.
The I think the questionnaire could be problematic if it came with a check, right? And you know, you're presented with a series of boxes that, you know, result in the check being good, and the series of boxes that result in the check being no good, right? If you, you know, because that's what the idea would be. Again, I don't think the contribution is made in an exchange for an agreement to alter your position.
Usually they just bold the right answer. But on that point, it's a great question, because a lot of times they require you to sign it and date it and agree to the following things. And I hate that, you know, because it bothers me, and I've gotten to the point where I almost don't answer them anymore, because I don't know. I mean, I know generally where I think I go, but I can't 100% say. But early on in your career, when you're running for the first time out of the gate, I mean, you're looking for people to support you. So you're signing these things. And sometimes they come with forums. And I'm thinking about different forums I've been in. I won't say any specifics, but just there are forums that go on where members of these forums, members of these groups, will ask you questions. And you might be there with your opponent, and they'll say, would you agree to this or would you agree to that? And we are not going to support a candidate who will not agree to XYZ position. And they're fairly forward about it.
And I think that's another good example of the normal political process working to achieve sort of its, each group working to achieve their own goals. But and we do have a representative from the Department of Law who might be able to help us out with this, just on the issue of whether there's been a quid pro quo,
yeah.
Whether there's been an exchange, a deal made for you to change your mind in exchange for that contribution. Even in those forums where I agree, there's a lot of pressure to sort of agree with the folks that you're appearing in front of or speaking to.
And just if I might, Mr. Chairman, just to give you a great, great example of how it could occur that I could see would be, you're in a forum, you're with your opponent, you're asked a direct question from a member of an organization that you know has a PAC, and they say, Senator McGuire, in the past you have voted for tort reform. And do you agree to change your position on that? And I say, yes. And sometimes they make you just hold up these cards. You don't even get to say, well, I went to Mecca and thought about it, and this is why.
Right.
In fact, they cut you off when you do that. You just hold up, do you agree or not? Yet, red or green.
Chamber of Commerce.
Okay. Then after that, there's an evaluation made on some level based on what you've said, and then you get a check or you don't.
And the whole transaction was caught on TV.
Yeah, usually is.
Right. And I think that's close, but what you didn't get is the explicit agreement that you're changing your mind in exchange for the contribution. I agree that's an example of money and power being persuasive, but you didn't change your mind in exchange for the money. Senator, yeah, please, we do have Ms. Carpinetti here who can help us out with the law with respect to bribery and so forth.
Actually, I don't think you need any help at all. You're just fine. But there is one thing that I would mention is that, you know,
if you put yourself on the record, just...
Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Annie Carpinetti. I represent the criminal division of the Department of Law. And you know, what this bill does, it changes the definition of benefit. And benefit is then used in the bribery statute, which is a specific intent crime. So there's even another layer of having to prove specific intent in relation.
And could you remind us just what specific intent is?
It means you do an act with a specific intent of getting a result out of that act. Like intent to kill, you do an act that you intend to cause the death of somebody.
And do the members of the committee have any questions for Ms. Carpinetti based on that? What you're telling us is that it's the most difficult type of crime to prove is the type of crime where you have the specific intent mental element.
Yes. And that's why there aren't very many of them. If you look in the case law under the statute.
Senator Terry.
And Mike, you mentioned, well, you're with the criminal division. This section of statutes is in the criminal division, so we're also dealing with, before any charges are brought, there's going to be some prosecutorial discretion. I mean, we're not setting ourselves up here.
It's not an Ethics Act issue.
Okay.
Good point.
I just want to make sure that it's clear that somebody doesn't say, oh, well, Terry O voted you know, counter to what he used to. And, oh, isn't it interesting? We go back in his campaign contributions. He got $100, and so therefore he's up on a bribery charge now. That's, you know, that's not going to happen.
Yes, we do exercise our discretion most of the time.
Other questions or comments from Ms. Carpinetti? Senator Huggins.
Yeah, please, Annie. The chair made the comment multiple times that this probably wasn't enforceable unless you had a recording, I think was the words. Your thoughts?
Through the chair, you know, that's an interesting question. I when I saw this bill, I looked back at the couple cases that have been prosecuted, and I think the one that I'm familiar with did have a wire, and that was a former legislator, actually. It wasn't a campaign situation or anything, but it was a bribery prosecution. And the other one, I'm not sure of. I'd have to double check.
Thank you, Ms. Carpinetti. Further questions for Ms. Carpinetti? Further discussions? Sorry, Senator Wilikowski.
I was hoping you might be able to give us a little bit of clarity on some of the questions that we asked. For instance, and again, I think this is important to have on the record, your opinion of whether or not we have a situation where someone answers a questionnaire and then they send it in and they get a $500 check from the organization, or whether or not the situation that Senator Terrio just talked about where someone changes their vote and then they had a campaign contribution. Do you foresee those situations being bribery under this bill as it's currently drafted?
Through the chair, those situations don't involve the quid pro quo that the chairman was talking about, the bargain, the meeting of the minds. We give you this for that. You know, that there's a delay of time. You give your position on a questionnaire, and a citizen decides, well, based on those questions, I'll support you with money, but it wasn't in exchange for the position. So it's a different situation.
Do you, if I could just, a slightly different topic, do you, this currently says to alter an elected official's position, and I'm wondering if you see any merit to maybe adding something that says, because if someone comes to a candidate and they don't have a position at all and says, hey, I'll give you $500 if you vote yes on X, that seems to me to be bribery, but it doesn't seem to be covered under this statute the way it's written. Would you agree with that?
Yes, I would agree with that. I suppose you could say to take or alter, but I would want to think about that pretty carefully, too.
Alter, like, or maintain?
But I guess I would like to give that some serious thought, too, about what that would mean. Off the top of my head, I mean, that would certainly answer the question, but whether that would have unintended consequences.
And then just one slightly another area. Do you interpret this provision as applying to both the briber and the bribee?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Carpinetti. Further discussion among members of the committee? Senator Huggins, do you maintain your objection?
Remove my objection.
You remove your objection. Is there further objection to Amendment Number 1? Hearing and seeing none, Amendment Number 1 is adopted.
Oh. Move fast.
I tried to telegraph where I was going.
I was just
the bill hasn't left the committee.
Why don't we? Sure.
You're not sending it to me next, are you?
Yes, ma'am, I am.
Okay.
We can fix it in state affairs.
Let's take a brief at ease while we distribute another amendment. Judiciary Committee will come back to order. Amendment number 2, stylized backslash echo dot 7, is also by myself. I'll move it and ask for an objection.
Objection.
Thank you, Senator Huggins. Amendment number two follows up on the conversation we had on Monday regarding the use of state aircraft and the jet. We reviewed the APOC decision and the opinion of Mr. Jones with respect to the way you allocate the uses of the jet and what's okay and what's not okay. And it just struck me that we were sort of wrestling with an unusual question. I kept in my mind coming back to the idea that this was a piece of state equipment, that we are all prohibited from using state equipment for partisan political uses, that I don't think I could look the public in the eye and say, well, I use my legislative office most of the time for legislative offices, but once in a while I throw a fundraiser in there because I'm a legislator and I'm busy and doggone it, that's my office, and I just wanted to throw a fundraiser up there. I don't think any of us would tolerate that. It would be a clear violation. And in my mind, the state aircraft falls under the same heading. It's a state asset. It's piloted by state employees. It flies with state fuel in it, and it's covered by a state insurance policy. And while I recognize, and we had a good, I think, elucidation of the fact that the governor is a complex person with a full-time job that doesn't allow for the filling out of leave slips, that the use of state facilities to further partisan political purposes is just not good. And so what the amendment does is essentially two things. In Section 6, and the reason that says Section 6 is because it's trying to fall into the bill in a certain place, and we'll deal with that in cleanup. But basically on page 2, the top of the page, it just adds state aircraft to the list of things that a public officer may not use. And just to read into the record how it would now read, starting on page 1, and it says a public officer may not, skip down to subsection 6 on line 21, use or authorize the use of state funds, facilities, equipment, services, or another government asset or resource for partisan political purposes. This paragraph does not prohibit the use of the governor's residence for meetings to discuss political strategy, and does not prohibit the use of state aircraft or the communications equipment in the governor's residence so long as there is no charge to the state for the use in this paragraph for partisan political purposes, et cetera, et cetera. And the reason we're adding the state aircraft into the same category as the governor's residence, to make clear that it's not against the law for the governor to sit in the aircraft and talk about politics, to talk about political strategy, to talk about partisan political strategy. I don't think there's any way to separate that sort of realm of the governor's existence from his or her travel on the state aircraft, just like there's no way to separate it from his or her use of the mansion. It's a place where you're going to spend a certain amount of time, and so it shouldn't be an ethics charge or an ethics violation to have that conversation. But the more important restriction in the amendment is in Section 7, and it's a new subsection. I'll just read it into the record so the public can follow along with our discussion. Subsection 7, beginning on line 11, page 2, says, use of state aircraft for partisan political purposes is permitted under B of this section, the one we just discussed, only when the use is collateral or incidental to the normal performance of official duties and does not exceed 10% of the total use of the aircraft for official purposes and partisan political purposes combined on a single trip. A public officer who authorizes or makes any partisan political use of a state aircraft under B of this section shall disclose the authorization and use under a series of reporting statutes for each trip, and the person who uses the aircraft shall reimburse the state for the actual cost of the use. So the idea is to allow for the fact that if the governor takes the jet to a bill signing and it's during a campaign season, there may be some, you know, sort of inescapable incidental use of that travel to accomplish some partisan political end. But it should be minor. It should be really minor, in my view. And if there is some need to have a big fundraiser or some other event, then in my view, the governor should not be taking a valuable state asset and using that to achieve that partisan political end. So that's the idea behind the amendment, and I'd be happy to take questions from members of the committee.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure. What does the 10% apply to? The 10% of the time he spent engaged in activities?
It's if you were to, in my view, you'd take the amount of time on the trip, amount of time that was spent on partisan political ends during the course of that trip. Viewing each trip as a separate chunk of time.
And how did you come at the determination that 10% is the right number?
It's a policy call. I'd be happy to entertain other ideas, but I think it's, in my view, it should be, it can't be zero. I think it's impossible. Yeah, I just don't think you can get to that. But we're operating now under a theory that something around 46, 47, 48% is okay, or maybe okay, and it just strikes me as being way too much. Mm-hmm. Other questions or comments?
Would this apply to the governor's chauffeur vehicle?
The amendment is targeted to the aircraft, the jet, for a couple reasons. One, because it's 10 times more valuable in my mind than a chauffeur vehicle. And
related to state government assets.
That's the...
and resources.
Right. Maybe Mr. Jones can help us out with the legalisms.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Dave Jones. I'm an assistant attorney general with the Department of Law. Senator Huggins, through the chair, as drafted, the amendment would not, as the chairman mentioned, cover chauffeured vehicles. One of the difficulties in attacking the problem of use of chauffeured vehicles is that the governor, due to security concerns, is frequently required to drive in chauffeured vehicles. If we had a rule that said you may not have security accompany you when you go to a political event, then someone who was targeting the governor would know, all I have to do is wait for a fundraiser and show up there. In addition, if we required that the governor use something other than a state vehicle, the burden on the security detail of checking out a rental vehicle, for example, to ensure that it was safe, would substantially increase.
So what would government asset or resources be other than aircraft?
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, that would be a variety of things. I think that if the governor were, for example, to use the state, the governor's residence, the governor's office, similar.
So we already talked about the residence. You can use that.
For very limited purposes, for political strategy discussions, and for the communications equipment at the governor's residence. The governor could not, however, hold a fundraiser at the governor's residence.
Okay. Or at least for partisan political purposes.
Correct.
If you wanted to help breast cancer, you can do that, or
correct.
Boys and Girls Club. Thank you. Just a clarification. Senator McGuire.
Thank you. Mr. Jones, you may not know this, but you start talking about it with security. So how does it work? We're going to make the change with the aircraft, which I think is the right policy call. Is there a security detail that would travel with the governor when she, hoping it's a she always, just teasing, she or he flies on a commercial aircraft? Is there a security detail for which we'd be required to purchase tickets for? How does that work? It's an odd transition if you're campaigning and you're already the governor. Do you know anything about that?
Through the chair, Senator McGuire, I don't know the details. My understanding is generally that the governor is accompanied by security. I just don't know the details, the ins and outs in particulars. And it's probably good that I don't.
Just for the record, I saw our new governor flying with us on a Sunday night not too long ago. I think maybe Senator Huggins was on the flight in coach. I don't know if she was surrounded by burly security detail or not, but it didn't look like it because the airplane was full of us stragglers.
She usually has Piper along with her, though, as a security contingent. It's my experience. Mr. Chairman, so this deals with just the state-owned aircraft, and I'm... I mean, this is a strange dynamic of perhaps the governor flies up to Fairbanks on a Friday on the jet, wants to spend the weekend, and maybe there's going to be a number of campaign things happening through the weekend, and can't do that. Mm-hmm. Could take the state jet back to Juneau and catch a commercial flight up, and then be free to do whatever he wants. And that, you know, I don't understand what you're trying to get at here. I'm just not sure how to artfully get at it. Also, this doesn't speak to an issue of a governor flying up commercially and then engaging in lots of campaign stuff. I mean, the governor could fly up in coach to Fairbanks on Friday, engage in all kinds of political stuff through the weekend after signing the bill, you know, official duties on Friday, and no problem. So it's all just contingent on this particular piece of equipment, or...
Maybe Mr. Jones can answer that better. I don't think it's no problem. It depends on who paid for that plane ticket, right? But maybe Mr. Jones can elucidate that a little more.
Mr. Chair, Senator Terrio, I think you hit the nail on the head. The current rules would apply, and there would be a required allocation of the cost if the state paid for the plane ticket, and one of the purposes of the trip was to attend partisan political activities. Then the APOC rules would require an allocation of the cost.
Okay, but that system won't work for the state-owned aircraft?
Through the chair, Senator Terrio, under this provision, there would be a separate treatment of the state-owned aircraft.
And why is the system for a coach ticket versus flying up on the state jet, why can't the current system handle both?
Through the chair, Senator Terrio, that's a policy call.
So the current system does not cover the jet?
Through the chair, Senator Terrio, I believed when I wrote the opinion that we discussed on Monday that we had struck upon a system that would deal with this situation, the use of state aircraft under the existing system. I understand, both based on the sentiments expressed in the committee and in recent articles, that there are many people that disagree.
Okay, thank you.
And I think, to be fair to Mr. Jones, I mean, you could conceivably continue under the current system, but I think folks see those. There's a couple of highly valuable assets at the governor's disposal, and there's probably no asset more valuable than the jet. I mean, I just don't think there's anything else on the landscape that equals it as far as the value just as a commodity, a private jet. It's not, but it could be used as such if you don't construct tight rules to constrain its use. That's I think the concern of the public and certainly mine, and I think others as well. Mr. Jones, please.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. There are a couple points I wanted to make. I had an opportunity to review the amendment before the meeting began. There's a reference on line 17 to Alaska Statute 39.52.230. I'm not certain that we need that reference there, because the three statutes cited refer to reports of potential violations. The first, 210, is a report by a public employee. The second, 220, is a report by a member of a board and commission. The third, 230, is a report by anyone else. Now, the only public officers are members of boards and commissions and public employees. So if this is a reference to a public officer who authorizes or makes any partisan political use, then the only reports that are going to be made would be made under 210 or 220. Not under 230. It's a technical point. In addition, on line 18, there's a reference to reimbursement of the actual cost of the use. It wasn't clear to me whether someone who used the state aircraft for partisan political purposes would have to reimburse the entire cost of the trip or just a proportionate share that's attributable to the partisan political activities. I think if we've restricted the partisan political activities to 10%, it might be overwhelming to require the public officer to pay the entire cost of the use of the state aircraft, as opposed to something less than 10% of the total cost.
Mr. Jones, can you, I think the intent, certainly my intent, was to only require payment for that portion attributable to the partisan political purposes. Can you suggest some language that would achieve that goal?
What occurred to me just off the cuff was a proportionate share of the actual cost of the use.
I'm just writing down the proportional share of. And so your suggestion would be we, on line 18, insert the words, after the word for and before the word the, insert the proportional share of.
Correct, Mr. Chair.
I'll move that as an amendment to the amendment. Is there an objection?
Well, object just for the purposes of discussion.
Notice he's quicker now.
I just want an opportunity to look at it, and that's all. Can I speak?
Please.
Thank you. The way the bill is currently worded, are we prohibiting the governor from using the state aircraft, whether it's the Jet or the King Air, for all purposes, period?
Okay.
For political purposes, politically partisan purposes?
No. I mean, the short of the answer is no.
Outside of 10%, if it exceeds 10%.
Anything over 10% would be an ethics violation.
Yeah.
Okay. Under this, and I wasn't quick enough to get all that writing down, we're saying that they shall reimburse for the proportional share as long as it's under 10%, though. Is that a fair reading?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, that's correct.
Okay. So just for the sake of my own clarity, you would never have a situation where a governor would reimburse more than 10%, correct? Because that would be an ethics violation.
That's correct. Right. Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, my understanding is, as written, the amendment would say if it's more than 10%, you can't do it. You can't use a state aircraft. Take private aircraft. Okay. If it's under 10%, you're still not going to get the advantage of using state aircraft. We're going to level the playing field by making you reimburse the state for that portion of the cost of travel that's attributable to the partisan political activities.
Thank you.
So,
separate pointer on the amendment to the amendment.
Yeah, it's on the 10%. So,
Senator Wilikowski, do you maintain your objection?
I will withdraw my objection.
Is there a further objection to the amendment to the amendment? Seeing none, the amendment to the amendment is adopted. That brings the amendment back before the committee. Senator Terrio.
Just looking at the 10%, you know, if the governor goes up for something, takes 2 hours, that's 120 minutes. He can't do anything the rest of the day beyond 12 minutes. And I just think that's too tightly drawn. You know, should we have the allowance for the governor to have lunch with somebody and talk about politics, and that's okay? I think perhaps we should consider a different number than 10%.
Well, let's explore the idea, and perhaps we need to be more clear about how much time is involved. Do we consider the travel time and the time on the ground and the travel time back as a single trip, that is from Juneau to Juneau, assuming the travel began and ended here? Is that the relevant time period, or is it simply the time on the ground, or are we comparing it to the time performing the legitimate purposes? I think in my view, the easiest thing to do is view it as all one trip. So you're a little more liberal if you're gone for, it's Juneau to Juneau. If you're gone for 10 hours, then the relevant amount of partisan political purposes time, or the allowable political purposes time, is 1 hour. And that strikes to me as being fair. But if it's going to be more, if it's a two-hour fundraiser, you know, maybe you should be flying coach. Is that?
Well, the understanding that it's total takeoff to touchdown, mm-hmm. that certainly helps. I'm not sure, other than this discussion on the record here, whether that would be
any direction, right?
The way that this would be interpreted by the courts.
For the sake of argument, someone takes off in their jet from Juneau and gets weathered in, and we all know how the travel can be. And I mean, the travel can be a huge amount of time, and if they attended, say, a 1 hour or 2 hour fundraiser, there is a vast amount of travel involved. I just don't know if travel is the best indicator of this, but I don't know that we really need to decide that at this point. Is there, I guess I look to you, to the attorneys, whether there is, how that is defined currently.
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, I struggled trying to come up with some language of my own, and I have to compliment the chair, Ms. Smith, and the drafter, Dan Wayne. I think they did a remarkable job on a very, very difficult concept, because I struggled with some of the same issues that you've discussed. I don't think that the Attorney General's office would have difficulty in interpreting trip, a single trip, as being takeoff to touchdown. I think that would be the natural inclination. I can't, of course, speak for the personnel board, which might be in the position of enforcing it, or for the court system.
Further comments or discussion of the amendment? Senator McGuire.
Thanks. And I think, you know, it's important to point out the intent is to change behavior. The intent is to change the way things are done, and I think it will be, to a degree, inconvenient for a period of years until people figure out that that's the way things are done. So what it will require is incumbents to start making a better separation between the office of the governor and their political activities. And for some people, I think, certainly many people in my district believe that blurring of those lines has been inappropriate. And I don't mean to cast aspersions at any one particular political figure, but it would just simply require a governor to sit down and say, you know, this day is going to be all political. And we're going to get on this commercial flight, and we're going to fly to this city, and we're just going to give it all we've got that day. We're going to meet with all the groups. We're going to do the political rally, the fundraiser, the whole deal that day. The next day, we're going to get up, and we're going to go on the jet, and we're going to go to Sitka, and it's going to be all business. Going out to the academy, and we're doing some bill signings, and we've got things we've got to do, and it's all business. And if people want to start to, you know, talk to me about politics, I'm going to say, hey, I'm here on business today. And kind of what we do in our offices when I think about it. If anybody starts to talk to you about a contribution or whatever, you just say, hey, you know, I'm in my political office. I'm in my legislative office. We're here to talk legislation. And so I think it's really, you know, we're talking about numbers, and I get the point of practicality. But the point really is to change behavior and a way of thinking about things that's different than we've done.
Thank you, Senator McGuire. I think that's right. Just while we're considering the bill, let me make one more amendment to the amendment, and that is to, accordance with the advice of Mr. Jones on line 17, page 2, line 17, strike the words or 39.52230 from the amendment. Is there objection to that amendment? Senator Wilikowski.
Well, just a real technical change, but you probably want to add, take the comma out after 210 and add an or there, and then take the comma out.
So the amendment to the amendment is to on line, actually, we'll rephrase the amendment, because you can't do it a third one. You got to do this one
second
as a second. Yeah. So the amendment will now be on page 2, line 16, after 210, delete the comma,
delete
insert
the
word or.
Should it be or and? I'm assuming it should be or.
It's or.
And then after 220, delete the comma,
delete
and then
the comma.
Delete the or 39.52230.
Oh, you're a Harvard comma guy, are you?
Is there objection to the amendment as stated by myself and Senator Wilikowski in collaboration? Does the secretary understand the amendment? Thanks for that honest answer. Hearing no objection, the amendment is adopted. That brings the amendment back before us. Is there further discussion among the committee members about the amendment? Senator Huggins, is your objection maintained?
I didn't object.
Let me just put it this way. Is there further?
Do you object?
Okay, I very much.
Further
objection. Is there further objection to the amendment?
Act quick.
Then the hearing and seeing no objection to amendment number 2, it's adopted, which brings the bill back before us. The intent of the chair would be, since we've made two fairly substantive amendments, to prepare a clean CS and to bring the bill back before us tomorrow to see that the sections would be renumbered accurately and that we have a cohesive bill. And it'd be my intent to move the bill out of the committee first thing tomorrow when we meet in the afternoon. Let's set that bill aside for the time being then.
If I could,
I'm sorry, Senator Huggins.
Just for the record,
yep.
Just a concern I have is that it's always interesting when you have an official that's unpopular, how closely we scrutinize their conduct and report on it. And I just hope that what we're doing here doesn't result in something in the long run that will haunt some people, different people sitting in this room or interpreting and going, what in the world were those people doing?
It's a good observation, Senator Huggins.
It thoroughly concerns me.
It's true. And so someone else recently said, and it's a truism amongst lawyers, that bad facts make bad law.
Yep.
And you have to be very aware of that. And I appreciate the observation. I don't disagree with it at all.
So I'm listening to this and reluctantly accepting it.
And that's another reason, I think, for holding it over to see a clean copy. So with that, let's turn now, because we've had some folks waiting, to SB 78. SB 78 is motor vehicle window tinting. Let me read the sponsor statement into the record, and then we'll go to public testimony because folks have been waiting very patiently. SB 78, illegally tinted windows cause a number of safety concerns in Alaska's local communities. The dark tints create a danger for peace officers who approach vehicles, as they can completely block any view of the driver and passengers. In addition, these tints deny pedestrians, bikers, and motorcyclists the opportunity to confirm that they have been seen by a driver when meeting in an intersection or sharing a roadway. Currently, it is illegal for a vehicle to be on Alaska's roadways if the window tinting allows less than 30% of the light to transmit through the glass. However, it is not illegal for higher levels of tinting to be installed by auto detailing shops and similar businesses. SB 78 would close this loophole by making it a misdemeanor to install illegal window tinting. The bill would also help enforcement efforts by allowing police to, quote, go to the source, unquote, by bringing charges against installers. Please join me in supporting this legislation. We have about 20 minutes left. I have a bunch of folks lined up to testify. If the committee members could hold their questions for me about the bill until we've heard from some of the public, I think that'd be fair to all involved. Let's go first to the Fairbanks LIO, where there are three folks signed up to testify, Mr. Boswood, Mr. Felt, and Mr. Vincent. Gentlemen, if you'd line yourselves up in the order I just gave your names, and if you could limit your testimony to about 3 minutes, and perhaps each of you could address something that the other did not speak to, the committee, I know, would be happy to hear your testimony. Mr. Boswood, are you on the line?
I am on the line.
Thank you, sir. Please put your name on the record. Let us know who you're affiliated with, and the committee would be eager to hear your testimony.
My name is William Boswood, Bob Boswood. I own a company in Fairbanks called Auto Trim Design of Fairbanks. Been in business since 1984. We employ about 35 people. We do a lot of truck accessories, as well as one of those being installation of window film. My purpose here today is to perhaps try to educate y'all and to portray a less prejudicial look at what window film is. As you drive down the road, I know you see the dark windows, and I'm in agreement. I want to make eye contact with those people, but I want each and every one of you to know that as you drive down the road and you see other vehicles, and there are vehicles there that are tinted, and you are able to see the people inside. You have clear view. Police officers have a view of the inside of the vehicles. These windows have been tinted aftermarket-wise by reputable firms who have self-regulated themselves since 1994 and not put dark limo tint on windows, because we feel it's not safe either, okay? We want to go back to the original regulation and have that change to where this industry, which we have built and is part of our business, we want it to survive. You guys are killing it. This bill will kill it. And, you know, I have two full-time employees that their livelihood is installing window film. There is window film that both meets the needs of the safety issue, but it also meets the needs of the customer. Customers have to want to buy it, and what customers look for, they look for glare reduction, they look for UV protection, and they also, quite honestly, look for a little bit of a cosmetic look, okay? There are also unscrupulous people who are tinting windows very darkly to conceal perhaps illegal types of activity going on in the vehicle. We are certainly against that. We've been against this original regulation since the beginning in 1994. They went from having no regulations in this state to having one of the second only, the most restrictive regulations in the whole nation, and second only to Rhode Island. Now, other areas of high crime, Los Angeles, Florida, Texas, you name it, they all have reasonable window tint regulations that allow the window tint industry to survive, okay? This passage of this bill, we want to make the installation of illegal tint illegal as well, but we'd like to go back and change the regulation to where the regulation, what is legal, will allow us to survive and keep our customers happy. I have many more things to say, but limited to 3 minutes, I'll let my other people here talk to you as well. But I just want you to know that as you drive down the road, there are tents, windows tinted, that you do not know they're tinted because they're not drawing attention to themselves, okay? They're tinted, and they're meeting all the needs of the people that wanted them tinted. The regulations from the state right now, when you tint those windows with a 70% light transmittance on the front, 40% on the back, it's invisible. You can't even tell there's tint on there. The only customer that wants to buy that is the ones that want the UV protection, which you can get with that light of a tint. I'll move on to Mr. Felt.
Mr. Boswood, thank you. I'm sorry, Mr. Boswood, we do have one question for you from Senator Willikowski.
Very good.
Hi, thank you for your testimony. And you said that this bill would kill your industry, if I heard you correctly. And I'm looking at the bill, and I guess my question is, it will only kill the industry if people are essentially violating the regulations, correct?
Yes, sir. But you know, the regulation to begin with was way too restrictive, okay? In that if the customers, you show the customer what 70% light transmittance is, and they see no value in it, okay? The only value that it has to the customer buying a vehicle is the fact that it does have a 98% UV protection, okay? It reduces no glare, and it has no cosmetic effect at all.
So if I'm hearing you correctly, then is it fair to say that large numbers of these that are installed by tinting companies are in violation of the regulations?
Any film that you put on a vehicle that you can see is in violation of the regulation. The regulation is too restrictive.
So the vast majority of your tinting that you're doing is in violation of the regulation?
Yes, sir. Absolutely, 100% of the tinting that we do, the manufacturers don't even make a 70% light transmittance film. The windows of the existing vehicles from the factory come with natural glass in it. That natural glass already has about 85% light transmittance on it, okay? Just clear glass. When you add 70% film to it, it actually does decrease it to less than the 70%, so it's actually still in violation. If there were a 70% film manufactured and it was installed on the front vehicle, front windows of the vehicle, it would be in violation. There is no tint manufactured that would be in compliance with the regulation from 1994. We would like to see that regulation changed and then make the installation of illegal window tint illegal and start penalizing the businesses that do that. I'm 100% in favor of that.
Thank you.
Mr. Boswood, thank you. That's good information for us. Next up is Mr. Felt.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, sir.
My name is Andrew Felt. Work for Auto Trim Design. Hard to really top what Mr. Boswood said. I have been in the business of installing window film for over 20 years in several different states, working with several different sets of state laws. I'm in complete agreement with the sponsor statement that windows darker than 30% light transmission are a problem. As Mr. Boswood stated, the fact is that section, I've got it here in front of me, the state regulation on window film, and Title 13, Chapter 4, Section 223, does require a minimum, maximum 70% light minimum 70% light transmittance. That number is just basically what the vehicle rolls out of the factory with. We also have the existence of sport utility vehicles, minivans, pickup trucks. Those are all allowed right out of the factory by the federal regulations as to how those vehicles are built to have dark glass on the back. This only would affect the front windows on those particular types of vehicles. Our company policy is to only tint down to 35% window film on any front door. That is our strict policy, and we lose business every day because we will not do it as dark as some people wish to have. As far as our local window film business here, we do a thriving business in it, and actually have very, very few people ever come back that have had a run-in with the law enforcement where they've had been required to take it off. I think this is reflected in the fact that the law enforcement are not uncomfortable with vehicles that we have put this window film on. Most of the people that have had problems are from out of state, military transfers that come up from states where window film is, say, less, the restrictions are less strictly enforced. There is no state in the country that allows anything darker, really, than 35% film on any window. So anything, if you cannot see into a vehicle, it has been tinted illegally somewhere. This law would basically just run out of business, all of us doing it for a living, and transfer that into a black market of people doing it on their own, buying window film kits on the internet, using film they can buy at Lowe's or Home Depot that's intended for houses to put on their windows. I don't think this will stop those people who want their windows too dark to begin with from doing it. I think it would just erase an entire business, my job, the job of one of my coworkers, and several other jobs, I'm sure, through the state, and that money will go into a black market that's not taxed, not regulated, and uncontrolled.
Mr. Felt, thank you very much for your comments.
Thank you.
Mr. Vincent.
Hi, Steve Vincent, Auto Trim Design General Manager. Members of the State Judiciary Committee, I'm going to address, rather than kind of what we do, what I see with the proposed bill. It appears to empower the regulation of tint laws as it applies to businesses, in our case, or individual installers, to the DMV. It also seems to allow the DMV to make departmental changes to tint laws via internal interpretation and memo. It's not acceptable to us because it would allow the baseline to shift at the whim of a department head. Right now, it's a state regulation. It just seems to be a shift of power here. The other thing that I wanted to point out here is on the sponsor statement, the opening paragraph here. We can agree with it. I don't see any meat to it as far as specific instances of deaths, collisions, instances from state troopers where they've had problems with dark tint recently, especially in our area up here. And one last thing that I want to reiterate is that almost everybody associates dark tinted vehicles with the little sports cars that are running around, or the bling bling vehicles with all the, you know, the big wheels and the big tires, and you can't see into them. There are an awful lot of vehicles running around that have 35% tint, and if you have seen a vehicle with 35% tint, chances are you didn't even realize that it had tint in it. It's a very light tint, and we think that that the law ought to be changed to reflect what an awful lot of other states are allowing, especially as we've learned more about the effects of UV and the effects of direct heat on infants and, geez, on our bodies in general. That would be all I have. Are there any questions?
Only that we envy you if you're getting sun there, sir. We're in Juneau.
Well, this is Mr. Boswood again. I'd like to add one further comment. This is a very important issue for us, okay? And, you know, we've got people's lives at stake, people's ability to feed their families at stake here. okay? The fiscal impact may not have any fiscal impact according to the fiscal notes from the law department, but there's definitely a fiscal impact to at least two people here in the Fairbanks area, and I'm not sure there's other businesses here in town that are tinting windows that are not aware of this regulation proposal here. If you all, I mean, I'm serious enough to where I'll fly to Juneau, I'll tend a car in within the 35% limits, which we set ourselves to show you that it is a safe venture, and please, please, you know, consider that. And because the way it's written right now, you're going to put that portion of our business is going to be gone. And the other side of that coin is that we also do commercial glass. We do interior glass in offices. We do security films. If you take one part of that away, take the automotive away, the rest of it is not it will not support itself. So you're taking a little bit of industry. I know it's small, but Alaska's pretty small. But you're gonna it'll just be gone, and we'll have to find other sources of revenue. I'm done. Thank you for your time. If you had any questions, please feel free to ask.
Mr. Boswell, we do have a question for you from Senator McGuire.
Thank you, and I am sympathetic, and I hope you recognize that, no one here is making light of that. Making laws impacts people's lives in dramatic ways. So if I heard you correctly, you're advocating for not a reference to the regulation because it's 30%, but rather to change it to 35%? Is that what I heard?
Well, ma'am, you've got the number is that we're quoting is the actual amount of light transmittance. Okay, the sponsor of the bill has it incorrect, which many people do get it confused as far as what the allowable light transmittance is. The regulation says 70%, and then 40% on the back glasses. Okay, sponsor statement talks about 30%. I mean, we'd be happy with 30%, but that's darker than 35%. He's just got his wires crossed there. He's not quite understanding what that light transmittance means is all. So 30% means that what he's saying there is a 70% tint means that it blocks out 30% of the light, okay? It allows 70% of the light to get through. So basically, that's it. What we would like to see is this bill to be put on hold, change the original regulation to allow a more medium tint to be installed on vehicles so that we can actually have something the customer wants and still be safe, and then go back and make it illegal for less reputable businesses to install tint that is illegal, okay? That's what we would like to see in a best-case scenario. I mean, this thing being revisited now. I'm sorry.
So we had one more question.
Just
for you.
In wrap up, then, if you could fax us what I'm looking for. I think we all know what we're looking for here. We want to prevent those vehicles driving down the road with the really dark black, where you can't see inside, and there's a potential for law enforcement to be off their guard and so forth. And so we all get that. And what you're saying is the way light transmission. It's the definition section, light transmittance as a problem. So could you fax those? Do you have a fax number, Hollis, to your office? Or 465-6595 is Senator French's office, because I'd like to just see what you're talking about, and maybe there's a way to define it the way you're talking about.
Okay.
Mr. Boswood, I'm sorry. I've got three other folks. I've been waiting patiently to testify.
I'm sorry. Okay.
That's okay. With 6 minutes left, I think the bill is going to be held over, and so there'll be plenty of time for us to discuss this in the future. But I do want to get to, if you'll excuse me, to the off-nets. We've got Lieutenant Reeder of the Anchorage Police Department waiting patiently. Ms. Reeder, are you still on the line?
I am.
Thank you. Thank you so much. If you'd put yourself on the record, the committee would be eager to hear your testimony.
I don't know if I necessarily have testimony, but I'll put myself on the record first. It's Lieutenant Nancy Reeder. It's R-E-E-D-E-R. I'm the traffic commander with the Anchorage Police Department.
Please go ahead with your testimony.
Thanks. I think I'm here more for questions than anything else, but there's a couple of things that I'd like to cover real quickly. The state statute is in line with federal law, first of all, as is the municipal ordinance, and I'm hearing a lot of testimony about 30, 35%, 70%, And from a law enforcement perspective, the state statute is very clear. There's not any issue with law enforcement on a confusion on that light transmittance. We know that there has to be 70% light transmittance that shows on those front windows, and it's very clear within the current statute. So from our perspective, I don't believe that a statutory change needs to be done at this time with the current tinting. And the bill itself, the new bill that we're here discussing, Senate Bill 78, appears also to be quite clear. It's referring back to the regulations and the statute and merely looking at addressing those shops which step outside that regulation, and we want to address those particular shops. I can tell you from a law enforcement perspective, with the officers that work for me and myself having gone out through the years and written these types of citations, that one of the biggest problems that we run into are those motorists who are, for lack of a better expression, ignorant of the law. They go to a dealership, they buy a brand new vehicle, they subsequently get stopped by a law enforcement officer because they have very dark windows, and they tell us, I bought the vehicle like this. They're adamant, and we know that they did. The vehicle's brand new. I bought the vehicle from the dealer just like this, but it's still an aftermarket tinting because the dealer brings in vehicles, and they send them out to these various shops to have add-ons put on, and then they sell the vehicle to the very unknowing, uneducated motorist. So what happens is that uneducated, unknowing motorist spends $2,000 or $3,000 more for a vehicle with a lot of add-on equipment, and then they're forced to have to go down and lose that money and have it taken off. So I think that's the spirit of what we're looking at here, is trying to address getting it stopped where it needs to be stopped, if that makes sense, rather than going after the innocent citizen. And if I can also say, the sponsor statement, I agree with the sponsor statement. There's one thing that was left out on that sponsor statement, and Senator Hollis, if I can add this to this, and I'm sure it's something from your days as a DA here in town. Not only is it the issue of the pedestrians and motorcyclists and bicyclists being able to make contact with that driver or with the eye contact with the driver, because that is an issue. But at nighttime, one of the things that's not addressed in the sponsor statement, when you're physically inside of a vehicle at nighttime that has darkly tinted windows and it's dark outside, your level of vision for outside that vehicle actually drops. Not your level, but your ability to be able to see from inside the vehicle outside actually is obscured. So that driver then becomes more of a danger to the pedestrian, the bicyclist, the motorcyclist, and other things, other obstructions that might be on the roadway. So it's not only the person on the outside looking in, but at nighttime it actually is that person looking out. And with the amount of vehicle pedestrian crashes we have in Anchorage and across the state, I think that's a huge issue for us.
Lieutenant Reeder, thank you. I think we have one question for you from Senator McGuire.
Very briefly, Lieutenant Reeder, how do you deal with those vans? It's a little pet peeve of mine that's always bothered me. The vans that have, and I recognize they're utility vans usually, but in the event that they are not, and they're vans that are used for mischief, and they just have the front window and the two side windows, how do you deal with those from a law enforcement perspective, and are you interested in changes to that?
And I'm assuming, Senator, and I apologize, I should probably never assume, but I assume that you're talking about the minivans, the passenger vans, sport utility vans?
No, I'm talking about the vans.
Panel
vans, where you can't see anything that's going on inside the van. All you can see are the two side passenger, you know, the passenger and driver window in the front part of it. And the whole back is covered in panels, metal.
Gotcha. Those, you know, there's always going to be, Senator, that vehicle out there that's difficult for us, obviously, from a law enforcement perspective, to be able to approach safely, unfortunately for us. But those vehicles and those particular vans that you're speaking of are actually legally tinted, as are the sport utility vehicles and pickup trucks. They actually are authorized under both federal and state regulations and state statutes to be darkly tinted, more darker than passenger cars and some of the passenger vans. So, and that is a little bit of a disparity that drivers say, well, what about the guy that just passed me in the van or the guy that just passed me in the truck? His windows are darkly tinted, and they're covered under the law. They're allowed to be like that. So, unfortunately, dealing with them just means that we have to be even more so cognizant of what we have going on. You're using more spotlighting. Sometimes we approach on a different side of the vehicle. If we're not sure what we've got inside the van, we may not actually make a full approach on the vehicle itself until we get cover there. There's different methods that we have to use to do it.
Thanks, Lieutenant. We've still got, thanks so much for waiting to testify. We've still got two folks at the Anchorage LIO, and we'd like to get through with your testimony today. So, Rob Hill, if you're there, we'd be, are you on the line, Mr. Hill?
Yes, I am.
Mr. Hill, go ahead and put your name on the record, and the entire committee's here waiting to listen to you testify.
Hi, I'm Rob Hill, owner of AutoStart Alaska, LLC. As with Bob, I'm also a tent installation center here in the city of Anchorage. I guess, you know, I've got some other comments just with regard to the law. I just have a hard time understanding why we are so concerned with this, where you've got southernmost states that have much more liberal laws with regard to how dark windows can be, where you've got crime in Texas, you've got crime in Southern California, New Mexico, Florida, Georgia. It's rampant down there, and yet they still have laws that allow tint that is darker than it is in Anchorage, Alaska. It seems a little, it's discouraging to me. We're a pretty responsible shop. We don't do limo tint on front windows. We don't believe in it. And I agree with Bob. I think that, you know, there should be some sort of a reasonable level of tint that we can use on the front of the glass for cosmetic reasons, for glare reasons, which also can add to the safety of the vehicle, especially in winter months when the sun is out and it's real snowy. I think it could be a benefit as far as safety. It's also a benefit with regard to safety when somebody is going to break into the vehicle. For instance, vehicles like mine, I carry a lot of expensive stuff in my car. I like to have a little bit of protection. I don't like people to see into my car and see my laptop through the front windows in the back seat. That's going to reduce the amount of law enforcement necessary to come out to my business or to my house to notice that my vehicle has been broken into. I have a hard time understanding also the seeing a bicycle or seeing a motorcycle. Number one, in the summertime in Alaska, which is another strong argument for this tent law or against the sponsor statement, it's light out all the time. In the wintertime, there aren't any bicycles or motorcycles on the street, which are going to be affected by poor night vision. It just seems odd to me. In the middle of summer, we're running anywhere from 18 to 19 hours of daylight. Especially in Fairbanks, it doesn't even get dark in the summertime. So I think a reasonable amount of tint on the windows, I think 35, even as dark as not 20%, which is on the back windows, I think it's a reasonable law. To bring charges against the installers, I think that is it's a huge can of worms that would be incredibly difficult for the shops, the employees. Anyone in this business knows that it would be almost impossible for us to internally police that. We do our best just as a responsible business, but I think it should be left into the hands of the consumer. If I'd like to take the risk of modifying my vehicle or customizing my vehicle, that's your risk. That's what you do. And we don't pre-load vehicles with tint. I've never done that. Remote starts, yes. But car dealerships, they do not put tint on vehicles, and I do all of the work for all of the Lithia dealerships in town, Lithia Chevrolet, Lithia Jeep, Chrysler. We've never tinted front windows preloaded in a vehicle, not once. And I've been in business since 1994. Auto starts, yes, but it's just not something that's normal practice. So,
Mr. Hill, thank you very much for your testimony. I don't see any questions for you. Senator Huggins, please. Mr. Hill, we have one question for you.
Yeah, Mr. Hill, I jokingly said to one of my colleagues here earlier what the meter looks like that you test the 70 percentile. Where do I buy one? Can you get one at Costco, or where is it?
Gosh, you know what? The thing about it is that, you know, like Bob had mentioned, if you put a meter on factory glass, it doesn't pass. We just let customers know right off the bat. We have for years. Look, it is not legal to apply, to apply film to the front of your windows. I have law enforcement officers that buy film at my store because they enjoy the comfort that the film provides. We strongly recommend it against using anything dark. We don't use a photometer because we know that anything tinted on front windows is illegal. Can't do it. So we tell people. We're very forthright. If you would like, we will customize this upon your request. But just bear in mind that if you get pulled over and somebody puts a photometer on it, it needs to be removed. And we charge $35 to do that service for people. But we don't have an issue. I mean, by and large, we don't, out of all of the tinting that we do, I might have one person a month that comes in to have tint removed. And we do quite a few tint jobs because we try to promote responsibility. With regard to law enforcement, just real quickly, though, I would recommend, if I was a law enforcement officer, I would recommend adopting some of the procedures that they use in the southern stage. Number one, I would not approach vehicles. I would require that
Mr. Hill, I don't mean to cut you off, but we've had people waiting. We've run over time.
Okay, and sorry about that.
Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
And we have one last person to testify, and that's Peggy Oth. Margaret Oth, if you're there in the LIO, please put yourself on the record, and we'd be eager to hear your testimony.
Yes, can you hear me, Hollis?
We sure can.
Yes, thank you for allowing me to address you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee. My name is Margaret Oth, and I'm a member of the Spinard Community Council. This actually came up in a community council discussion a year ago where we were concerned about some of the criminal activity that was going on in our neighborhoods. And there were vehicles that were going through with very darkly tinted windows that people could not see, the drivers or passengers, so they couldn't ascertain as to if, you know, by their demeanor, what kind of people they were, what they were doing in their neighborhoods. I'm also concerned as a frequent pedestrian. My husband walks to work every day. I have friends that bicycle and walk to work every day. I do a lot of bicycling in the summertime. You know, I agree with the gentleman who spoke before me. You don't always see their eyes when people are wearing shaded sunglasses, but you also can tell by the way that they position themselves towards you, sometimes the expression on their face, the tilt of their head. I've had people that have rolled across a crosswalk as I'm going across, and I've started into the crosswalk, and with darkly tinted windows, I don't know if they see me. I don't know if I should proceed or not. And sometimes it's just as dangerous to go behind them as in front of them, because if they advance, the person behind them may not see you and hit you. So it's a very unsafe condition, even in a marked crosswalk. The other thing I want to say very quickly is my neighbor was 18 years old and was given tinted windows for his birthday. He was caught by a police officer and ticketed, and when he took his truck in and said, "Why did you sell this to me knowing this was illegal?" they said, "Well, that's not our problem." And so he promptly had to pay for them to be removed. So the company was able to be paid in front for the tinting and then again on the back side for taking the tint off. And his family consulted my husband, who's an attorney, and they were thinking about bringing a small claims suit, and they wanted to know some of the procedures. They later decided not to do it, but they were out hundreds of dollars, and they are very, very unhappy people, and I don't think they're the only people in town that happened to. Thank you.
Margaret, thank you very much for taking the time to testify. With that, we'll conclude the Judiciary Committee hearing for today. We are adjourned.